I think people thought we'd be incredibly insulted that Trump was rude to our Prime Minister, and that was objectively not the case.
I don't think Senator James McGrath cares too much about the feelings of Cuban Marxist revolutionaries.
It's been interesting that they say that the day is apolitical, but to move it is a political statement.
Back Chat, the alternative to talkback on SBI Radio.
Hello and welcome to Backchat, your fun and helpful guide to the news of the week. I'm Osman Faruqi.
And I'm Ariel Bogle.
The Greens, man, what a week. What a week. Where do we even start with them? What's going on? The party's lost two senators in the last week thanks to dual citizenship, constitutional eligibility issues, and there are questions to be asked now about the legitimacy of some others as well. We're going to be getting into all of that on the show today, including what it means for the future of the left-wing party.
Also today on the show, we'll hear from Serene Carson-Fox, a Canadian First Nations activist who recently took Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to an isolated Indigenous reserve as part of a Vice documentary. She shares her experiences with the problematic Woke Bay himself and her own experiences of being a young First Nations woman in Canada. Also, WestConnex. If you live in the Inner West, you can't have avoided seeing those posters absolutely everywhere, but you know, people are still pretty worried about the impact this major roads project will have on their neighbourhoods. There's a protest tonight, and we'll have Councillor Jess Miller in the studio to tell us a bit more about what the City of Sydney Council is doing on this issue.
Look, but first up, we've got to kick off the show talking about everyone's favourite federal politician, Peter Dutton, the most powerful man in Australia now. Malcolm Turnbull gave the controversial Immigration Minister a huge promotion this week. But before we get to what's going on in Canberra, let's do a quick refresher on the man of the moment himself, Peter Dutton. You might know him as Australia's Immigration Minister, but he's also a former Queensland cop who, according to his official biography, bought his first house when he was just 18. Damn, son, 18!
No avocado toast in the Dutton household.
Avocado toast wasn't that ubiquitous then, obviously, you know, aiding his home purchase. 18 is very, very young to have a house. But look, he's also made headlines for a bunch of other reasons, including claiming that former Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser made some mistakes when he allowed certain people to immigrate to Australia in the 1970s, specifically Lebanese Muslims. Bum, bum. And he claimed, without clear evidence, that asylum seekers were responsible for a riot on Manus Island in April. Police officers and other officials on the island denied this, not to mention the asylum seekers themselves also denying it. And of course, who could forget the time he joked about Pacific Islands going underwater due to climate change?
Ahead of the meeting, you were having a discussion with the Prime Minister about Port Moresby and the time that was taking one of the meetings, and you said, time doesn't mean anything when you're about to have water lapping at your door. What did you mean by that?
Well, I had a private conversation with the Prime Minister. I don't intend to comment publicly on that.
But what did you mean by that statement? It's being caught on camera. It's going to be seen across the Pacific Islands. What did you mean?
Well, as I say, I don't have anything to add to it. I had a private conversation with the Prime Minister and I don't have anything to say further to that.
You don't want to explain?
Are there any other questions
Malcolm
in relation to these matters?
So Malcolm Turnbull gave Peter Dutton a big fat gift this week with the announcement of a Home Affairs portfolio similar to the UK's Home Office. It will include the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation, better known as ASIO, the Australian Federal Police, the Australian Border Force, and the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission.
This was, of course, a captain's pick, given a recent review of the Australian intelligence community didn't recommend any such portfolio. And the idea has even been floated before by numerous governments, but, you know, ultimately rejected. This includes, of course, Kevin Rudd, who floated this idea and sort of cast it off back in his days as Prime Minister. So I guess the question is, what's this all about? Why do we need this UK-style Home Office here when things seem to be going pretty well? We have had minor sort of issues linked to terrorism, but ultimately, you know, people, experts in this area say the Australian intelligence community is doing a pretty good job.
But why indeed, Ariel? Very, very good question. But it's funny that you brought up Kevin Rudd earlier on. So when Kevin Rudd, in the 2007 election campaign, he floated this idea of a giant new Home Affairs kind of mega department and then pulled the balloon, unfloated the balloon, as they say, in the thick of it in 2008. Malcolm Turnbull was the opposition leader at the time, and he congratulated Kevin Rudd for killing off the idea of a Home Affairs department because he said it was a wasteful and expensive super bureaucracy that wouldn't fix any problems. Here we are now, 9 years later, and he's created the allegedly wasteful and costly super bureaucracy. But it really does seem like this is about giving Dutton a fancy job so he can show off to his mates at the pub.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's hardly a week can go by without speculation about whether Malcolm Turnbull's going to get rolled out of the prime ministership by the right wing of his party, I suppose. And Peter Dutton has been the name most floated as a potential replacement for Turnbull, especially by those who want the party to return, I suppose, to a more right-wing location as it was under Tony Abbott. So is this a way to keep Dutton happy? And, you know, he's got all these new agencies to play with. He's got ASIO now. He's got Australian Border Force as well as he had before. But I guess, like, the person who loses most here, and I guess it has to be George Brandis, would
yeah,
you say?
Yeah,
because
for sure.
Brandis, of course, as Attorney General, is in charge of ASIO and most of the intelligence community, but now Dutton will sit above him, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think you're right. It does seem, you know, there's obviously this Liberal internal factional stuff at play. We've seen it on the plebiscite issue when it comes mm-hmm. to marriage equality. A majority of Parliament support it. The Prime Minister supports marriage equality, but because he's being held hostage by this conservative rump, he's not able to do anything.
Yep.
And it seems like every time the conservatives say, we want this, we want this, he gives it to them. And they want Peter Dutton, who, as weird as it is to like sane and normal people who don't think he's that good at being the immigration minister, to Liberal conservatives, he's like their flag bearer. He's the next Prime Minister.
Yeah.
He's the great white hope for the Liberal Party. But there's been some reports of dissent about his promotion. So you mentioned
right.
George Brandis. Julie Bishop as well is reportedly not happy with the idea. And back in March, I think a Liberal source told Sky News that Dutton was a fascist. That was the word that they used, and that he shouldn't be put in charge of this kind of department.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because there's been a bit of dissent coming out from the intelligence community itself, although, you know, not many people putting their names and coming out, you know, front and centre to
talk down
some of it.
Intelligence community, yeah.
But, you know, there's been plenty of experts, including people like ANU's John Blaxland, who's an security expert, you know, sort of questioning the usefulness of amalgamating things like this, because separating portfolios also allows one portfolio to act as a check on another. So, you know, by putting all these things together, that sort of, making sure that ASIO is accountable and the Australian Federal Police can hold other groups accountable is like less, because everything's sort of stuck together. Of course, Turnbull says this isn't the case and there'll be the appropriate checks and balances, because George Brandis, you know, Paul Brandis still has the ability to issue warrants for ASIO, but the head of the Home Office will too. So
he's kind of a glorified pen pusher now, basically, which, again, I don't really have a huge problem with. Look, coming up on the show, we're going to be talking about the recent Greens mayhem. So if you've got any questions you want answered in terms of, like, what is going on with the Greens, what's happening next, where does Scott Ludlam go, is there going to be a new Scott Ludlam, if you've got any hot takes about the situation, you can text us on 0409 945 945. We'd love to hear from you. So look, last week we spent a decent amount of time on the show mourning for the loss of Green Senator Scott Ludlam, who resigned in a shock announcement on Friday. And look, well, I think it's fair to say no one saw the absolute shitstorm that was about to follow for the Greens. Just days after Ludlam's resignation, Green Senator and co-deputy leader Larissa Waters also announced her resignation after realising she was actually a Canadian citizen and thus ineligible to serve in Parliament. Let's hear what Scott and Larissa had to say at their resignation announcements.
Recently, as about a week ago or so, it was brought to my attention that I hold dual citizenship, nationality of Australia and New Zealand. Under Section 44 of the Constitution, that makes me ineligible to hold elected office in the Federal Parliament. I apologise unreservedly for this. This is an oversight that was avoidable, and it's something that I should have fixed up in 2006 when I first nominated. I've got no wish to draw out legal uncertainty or create any kind of lengthy dispute, particularly when that section of the Constitution is so clear. So I'm resigning as a Senator for Western Australia and co-deputy leader of the Australian Greens effective today.
It seems that the law was changed a week after I was born, and in fact I should have actively renounced Canadian citizenship. I'll now obviously do that, and I just want to apologise to my party and to all of the wonderful Queenslanders that I've been so proud to represent in the last 6 years. It's been a real honour to speak for them and to stand up for things that I'm really passionate for.
Yeah, that was former Greens co-deputy leader Larissa Waters announcing her resignation from Parliament. And so within the space of a week, the Greens lost two-thirds of their leadership team and their most high-profile representatives. things are looking pretty messy, to say the least. And joining us to talk about where to now for the party is Stuart Jackson, a lecturer in the Department of Government International Relations at Sydney University. Stuart, thanks for joining us on Backchat.
No worries at all.
Look, let's start at the beginning. How on earth did this happen? And what kind of party loses 20% of their party room to a technical oversight?
Well, firstly, it's a technical oversight. secondly, it's to do with the structure of the Constitution, the way it's written. This has been an issue, and it's been around for a good 30-odd years, going back to 1987, when Robert Woods was found to be not an Australian citizen and had to resign. It's come up again. Heather Hill for One Nation was lost. So it's not the first time it's happened, but Section 44 was supposed to be about keeping out the unwanted people as opposed to necessarily British subjects. Of course, time has evolved. These former British subjects, i.e. Canadians and New Zealanders, are now New Zealanders and Canadians.
Right.
Larissa's is particularly interesting because at the time she was born, she, as a Canadian, would be Canadian, comes to Australia, becomes an Australian.
And her parents were Australian too.
That's right. She was Australian. That would have extinguished her Canadian citizenship. But between the time she was born and the time she came back to Australia, the laws changed and actually she was then able to retain her Canadian citizenship. She was completely unaware of that, that she was in fact a Canadian citizen. Born to Australians, she was thinking she was Australian. So it's kind of an odd situation. I kind of like the what Richard Di Natale did yesterday when at least he was able to say, no, I checked.
I've got the paperwork. I've got the receipts. Yeah. The major parties, it seems like, my understanding is they seem to have quite comprehensive processes for vetting. And even if there's like a skerrick of a doubt in terms of ineligibility, they basically take a super conservative approach on this. It seems like that is probably not what happened in the Greens. Why do you think that is?
Well, the major parties have been clued into it since 1992, the Cleary case, which actually the Court of Disputed Returns knocked out both the Labor and the Liberal candidates,
right,
as well as Cleary. Cleary was the most important one because he was the candidate who had won, the others because of Section 44. So it was a case of, okay, we'll make sure that doesn't happen so that we can actually win these elections.
Mm.
For the Greens, Scott's would have been, as he said, it's an assumption. He would have been questioned on it, but he would have said, but I know, I've done this. I'm not a citizen of New Zealand. I think where it's going to go is it's going to be produce the paperwork. Mm. If you were born somewhere else or you might be a citizen of somewhere else, it's possible to be an Italian citizen without actually knowing it.
Mm.
If your mother takes it up, then you get to be an automatic Italian citizen. So some odd curlicues around that. So it's going to be a case if you think you might be a citizen, you have to renounce it anyway.
I mean, at the end of the day, it does seem quite crazy that, I mean, two senators, the Greens don't have that many senators. And I mean, you can make allowances. They're a young party. Perhaps they don't have their processes in place that are so strict like the Labor or Liberal Party. But, what on earth?
Well, in part it goes to that question of, you ask people, have you renounced your citizenship? They say yes. Right? Mm. Where do you go with that? Do you actually say produce the document?
It potentially starts sounding a bit like Obama Bertha. But
yeah,
I guess after this has happened,
after today, that's what's going to happen.
It's going to happen. Yeah,
it's
going
to be, where's the paperwork? Where's the form? Where's the form you signed? Where's the receipt for that form?
Right.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's any role here in the sort of opposition research kind of thing that we're really familiar with from the US, where this is a whole industry. Every time somebody runs for office, there's, sort of freelance people digging into the background of each candidate, finding the skeletons in the closet, of which a citizenship you didn't know about would probably be one in Australia. Are we, less sort of stringent here with the eligibility of our candidates because we're not as afraid of that cottage opposition research industry?
I'm not sure if it's about opposition research that people are looking at. I think it's got far more to do with, we worry about our own. We don't worry too much about the other side because, tit for tat can start happening.
Yeah.
Indeed, that's the reason that Section 77, which is about how you appoint a new senator if someone resigns or dies, was put in there because that was, it started to become a bit tit for tat. So let's stop that happening. We'll be nice and, English, I suppose, in that sense.
Right.
It is one of the problems, though, Section 44, that's going to appear more and more particularly around citizenship, given that, what, 25% of Australia is born overseas?
Yeah, absolutely.
50%, you know, is born overseas or has a parent born overseas.
Right, both Ariel and I had dual citizens. Yeah. That's two-thirds of the people in this room right now.
I'm a dual citizen.
Oh, yeah, 100%. It's 100%. All ineligible to run for Parliament. What a joke.
Well,
the three people, if anyone in Australia should be running the show, it's us.
Definitely be us.
The Constitution.
So it's going to be a problem going into the future. I think it's not going to be easily changed, as I think a couple of commentators have pointed out. You know, you're going to ask, you know, to change this. Australians are going to go, of course you should be Australian. You should be only here for Australia. It rather misses the point, though, of course, that it means you may inadvertently bar a whole lot of people who are the very people you want in Parliament. And perhaps it says something about the Greens, that so many of them are born overseas or have these overseas, not allegiances, but connections.
Very cosmopolitan, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah, but when you saw there was a list going around of all the members of Parliament, senators who were born overseas across Liberal, Labor, even One Nation. And it was like quite a healthy list. You know, I'm trying to remember them all
Senator
now.
Senator Malcolm Roberts is probably the funniest
one. Born in
one.
India.
But his parents were migrants from the UK to India. He was then born in India and he then migrated from India to Australia.
Totally.
Now he's one of the most anti-migrant guys in Australian politics.
Yeah, so I guess having parents born overseas or being born overseas yourself is not doesn't immediately
doesn't
make you
guarantee
progressive on
you
immigration.
Know.
Yeah, look, let's talk about what this means for the Greens now, the next steps. There's been some speculation this week in terms of who the possible replacements will be for Scott and for Larissa. What's your understanding of the process around that, Stuart, and who's likely to end up in the Senate?
Well, it goes to a recount. That's the first thing. It actually needs a referral to the High Court, sitting as the Court of Disputed Returns. That will occur anyway. The Senate will do that as a matter of course. It's been very clear. People have said, I made a mistake. This is the reality. Mm. So that'll happen. There'll be a recount. The Andrew Bartlett, who was number two in Queensland, he will be then the next candidate after Larissa. That's a certainty. Steele John. He'll be the nominated person to replace Scott, and then they will take up their seats in due course.
And so there's some question mark about the timing, as I understand, because the Senate doesn't sit till the first week of August, and then that needs to, as you mentioned, pass a referral on to the High Court, then the High Court sits, it orders a recount, then the AC conducts the recount. So is it, we're talking a couple of months before we get...
It can be, yeah. You would expect it to be somewhere around the beginning of October, potentially. The recount itself will take a little bit of time, although it will not be... I mean, it could be a full recount that would elect someone new, that's always possible, but people who are already elected are not affected.
Right, okay.
So they were legitimately elected, they've legitimately taken their seats, so this will be a recount with them nominally stated, you will, you know, pass.
Right. You know? So let's just chat about the optics of all this, because, you know, apart from the sort of technical mechanics of replacing Scott Ludlam and Larissa Waters, there is a sort of ongoing reputational issue here, like, you know, and that there the opposition, both Labor and Liberal, will try to capitalise on. You know, the Greens are a mess, they can't sort out their candidates, they obviously aren't fit to do X, Y, Z in Parliament. Do you think this will have a long-lasting effect in that regard?
It'll have it in the short term. I mean, it's kind of... I made a comment on Twitter about it being at least it's a job lot. Mm. You know, and indeed it was. That was actually to a Liberal, as it happens. But at least it's done as a job lot. It's one horrible month, right? It may do serious reputational damage. It probably wouldn't if this was spread out over months and months and months. It was an ongoing thing. The trick now, though, is for the Greens leader, parliamentary leader Richard Di Natale, to step up, take the party forward, probably not to be doing the sensible centre thing at this point in time. He needs to be saying, no, we're going to stake out some new territory, we've got some new people in place, they will bring a mix of different ideas. You'll have, there'll be two vegans in Parliament now.
We could legislate veganism.
Although both the vegans would say we're not going to legislate. But you'll have Andrew Bartlett there, who is a safe pair of hands. He's, you know, he knows the ropes, he understands Parliament, had a lot of experience in terms of committee work, so he will actually be quite useful in that sense. Jordan brings a whole range of new skills and, in some respects, a lack of knowledge. At 22, that'll make him, you know, the youngest senator. he will bring us, hopefully, some enthusiasm for his particular issues. Yes, he may not remain a senator for very long. WA will probably have a pre-selection for the next election because his seat will potentially be the one that's up. And that's the other thing that has to be determined is, you know, who gets the 6-year, who gets the 3-year. The Senate will say potentially that because Scott wasn't there, it actually goes to the person who was elected, the first Green elected,
which will be Rachel. Yeah.
That said, reputational damage, I think it'll wear off. The Greens have to be, though, on the front foot. If they're on the back foot, they've been a little bit on the back foot of late, then it'll start to say, well, who are they? Where are they? You know, what are they actually doing? Look to the polls and look to how the party performs in the next 3 months. That would be my advice. Perhaps less cutting deals with the Liberal government and more taking a few stands and saying, no, actually, we do stand for full Gonski or whatever. You know, whatever issue that they need to pick up on.
So go to the left, you mean?
I think go to the radical as opposed to the sensible centre might be the way. Particularly, Catherine Murphy made this point, you know, that the party, the world at the moment seems to be looking for radical answers, whether from the left or the right. Being in the centre at the moment is not such a clever place to be. Although, that said, Emmanuel Macron managed that in France, but that's because the old parties had managed to, well, they'd imploded,
and he kind of ran through the middle between basically, you know, the far right and the far left.
He did a Bradbury. Yeah.
Yeah, well, Stuart, thank you so much for your time and insight on the show this morning. It's great having you on.
No worries at all.
That's Stuart Jackson, a lecturer in government and international relations at Sydney University, talking to us about all things Green.
So, we were just chatting about the Greens, but we'd love to hear from you. Are you feeling like you can't vote for the Greens after all this senatorial mess, losing two senators? You know, can you trust them with your vote next election? Let us know, 0409 945 945. So the experience of First Nations people around the world is often a story of lasting impact of colonisation, you know, intergenerational trauma caused by assimilation, racism and neglect. Sarain Carson Fox is a First Nations activist in Canada, and she's the host of a Vice documentary called Cut Off, where she took Canadian PM Justin Trudeau on an historic first visit to an isolated Indigenous reserve up there. And she spoke to our executive producer, Emily Jane Smith, about being Indigenous in Canada, meeting Justin Trudeau, and the similarities and the issues facing Indigenous Canadians and Indigenous Australians. And a warning, this interview explores issues of suicide. So if that raises any concerns for you, maybe just turn down your radio for the next 8 minutes.
Bojo Wabanango Queen Desnikas Wabazeshian Dodem Anishinaabe Queen Dao Bachuana and Donjaba Niso Medewian. So that's my traditional greeting, and that's my traditional name is Wabananango Kwe, which means morning star, but my colonial name is Sarain Fox, and I'm from the shores of Lake Superior in northern Ontario, and my reserve is called Batchewana First Nation.
Let's talk about the documentary Cut Off. So it focuses on an Indigenous community called Shoal Lake 40. Can you tell us a little bit about that town and how it's reflective of other Indigenous communities in Canada?
Yeah, so Shoal Lake 40 is quite an interesting community because it is not very far from quite a large town called Kenora, and it's just 24 kilometers off the Trans-Canada Highway, which is the major route from east to west. So it's not remote. However, they were made into an island when the city of Winnipeg, which is one of our largest cities, decided to build an aquifer and draw water from there. So they were actually physically cut off from the rest of Canada. That's why the documentary has that name, and they have been without clean drinking water for 30 years.
I did want to speak about something that's also affecting Indigenous communities in Australia here, and that's the rate of youth suicide. If you're comfortable talking about it, can you talk about your own experiences with suicide?
Well, absolutely. I think it's important to tell your story if you can. So that's why I'm very open about my father's suicide. I lost my dad when I was 15, and you know, he struggled for a really long time with substance abuse, and he was raised in foster care away from his community and experienced horrific treatment as a child. And I think no matter what your background is, we know that, you know, early childhood trauma really affects you and stays with you for your life. And so I think for me, I really understand the suicide epidemic from a personal perspective, but also I've lost many cousins and an aunt also to suicide. And so I think it gets to a certain point where you say enough is enough.
So in the Kimberley region, there's now an inquiry at the moment after a 10-year-old suicided last year. Why do you think this is happening to First Nations communities, not only in Canada and Australia, but around the world?
I think that this is happening as a direct result of intergenerational trauma. And, you know, I can't speak for the Aboriginal people here, but I can speak for my community at home and say that, you know, those effects have yet to be dealt with. You know, we're just starting to heal. We're just starting to reclaim who we are right now. We have 500 years of resistance in Canada, so that's 500 years of fighting against these things, and we're just starting to make progress now. So I can only imagine what that process is like here.
Mm. The experiences with removals of children and separation from families is also quite similar in Australia and Canada. Could you explain a little bit about residential schools and how that has contributed to intergenerational trauma in Canada?
Yeah. Yes, so residential schools were programs set out by the government, and they were enforced by the church to forcibly remove children from their homes. And the slogan was actually, kill the Indian, save the child. So the idea was to kill the Indian within the child so that you could have this humane child come out at the end. But what actually happened was rampant sexual abuse, physical abuse. We lost our language. They cut their hair. And I think really when you remove a child from their parents, how can you have a human that is able to then parent? Mm. So what we're seeing is that these people who went to residential schools were expected to go back to their communities and to live a normal life, and they were extremely damaged. And, you know, I'm a product of that because many people in my family went to residential school, and we're just starting to realize what that really meant.
I do want to talk a bit more about the contaminated drinking water. Can you explain a little bit about the issue of boiled water advisories?
Yes, yeah. So there are many northern communities. Actually, they're not even just northern. There are many communities across Canada, Indigenous communities, that are without clean water. And there's no real reasoning for it other than the sheer concept that the federal government does not move in and fix it.
In Western Australia here, a study was released just this week detailing how Indigenous communities are drinking contaminated water, and it's leading to things like kidney disease. How do you think it symbolises what First Nations people are going through?
Well, we're second-class citizens in our own homelands. That's how I feel when I'm home and I hear these stories constantly, you know. And I think it's an attitude. It really shows a general attitude towards the First Peoples of our countries, respectively, you know, in Australia or back home, where our lives are somehow never a priority. They're never the first priority, and I think that's something we really need to look at. And if you think that racism is not alive and well, these things are products of racism.
So I want to speak to you about the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, the great Justin Trudeau. In 2015, he made a lot of election commitments to the First Nations people in Canada. And in the documentary Rise Up, you actually delivered water with him to the people of Shoal Lake 40. And that was very symbolic because, of course, they can't drink the tap water in their community. Now, I'm going to play a little bit of an extract of one of the exchanges that you had with him.
So, are you going to make it part of your commitment to keep all the promises that you've made to First Nations communities?
If I made promises, it's because I intend to keep them. You know, and if I say we're going to eliminate all boil water advisories in 5 years and it ends up taking 5.5 years or 6 years, I think I'll be okay with that. If it ends up taking 20 years, then I did break my promise. And knowing that, you know, that these are goals, you know, these are goals and things that need to be done.
Okay, let's take it there. Now, this leader has excellent PR. So he's almost has a flawless public image around the globe. But I am interested to know what you really think about him. And you kind of, you know, holding back a little bit while I was playing that kind of told me a lot. So do you think he is serious or...
You know, I know what it sounds like. I mean, I know what it feels like to try and get yourself out of a solid promise. And I think that there's no way that that's not what that is. You know, he literally gives himself a way out. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a guy who has all of the resources in the world to say something, you know, really impactful. And I thought in that moment, he showed his true colors. And I think that was really hard for me to be sitting across from him and to hear him stutter that much. And what I will say is that I think he actually was incredibly overwhelmed. Mm. I think what we're actually seeing is a man who is taking in the realness of what he's been asked to do. So I think that he's been put in an incredibly tough situation because he's made a lot of promises.
Yeah.
And I don't think that the system is designed for him to be able to keep them.
What do you think are the key things that people need to remember going forward?
You need to let the First Peoples of the land control their own narratives. You need to let them start speaking about their own stories. You know, if I think representation is so important, whether it's in the media, the government, even teachers. You know, there needs to be representation everywhere. And I think that it's time to allow Aboriginal people to determine their own future.
Thank you so much for joining Backchat.
Chimi Gwech, thank you.
That was Backchat producer Emily Jane Smith, joined by documentary maker Serene Carson Fox. And you can watch that documentary Cut Off on SBS On Demand anytime. And you can also catch Serene. She has a new series, Rise, which premieres on Thursday, July 27 on SBS Viceland. She'll take you behind the front lines of some of the most prominent Indigenous rights protests across the Americas. And also just wanted to say that if this segment raise any issues for you, the number for Lifeline is 13 11 14.
And just before that segment, we've been chatting today on the show about the Greens' recent drama and their woes in Canberra with the loss of both Senator Scott Ludlam and Larissa Waters due to citizenship issues. We've had a few texts in on the line. There's one from Matt from Marrickville who says he read somewhere that maybe Larissa Waters could potentially renounce her Canadian citizenship and then take up the vacant seat again. Can you tell us whether that's feasible or why it can't happen? And same for Scott. P.S. will continue voting for the Greens. So Matt's absolutely right. There's nothing stopping either Larissa or Scott from renouncing their citizenship, and then therefore they would be eligible to run for Parliament again and could theoretically be appointed to their own positions. My understanding is that that is likely to be what happens with Larissa Waters. She is likely to throw her hat back into the ring in the upcoming Greens pre-selection for the next election. And from what people tell me, she's a pretty good chance of it. Whereas Scott has kind of made it pretty clear that he's bowing out of politics, at least for the next little while. So even if he technically could get back in, we shouldn't expect a Scott Ludlam return anytime soon.
Yeah, and definitely in their press conferences when they announced their resignations, Larissa's tone was definitely one of, you know, she was pretty... seemed extremely upset. Obviously, Scott was upset too to be leaving the Senate, and so more likely keen to get back in. And we also got another text from Sandra, and she said, personally, I'm terrified that with the Greens on the back foot, we will be further swamped with right-wing conservative policy pushes. I feel despair for my future and that of the countries, and it feels like there are less people to fight, or at the very least, less people to stand up and represent those who feel differently from others or have different needs to, you know, the mainstream public. Thanks for that text, Sandra. And I think, you know, they do seem very much on the back foot now. They lost quite a big swath of their vote in the Senate. But, you know, it's important to say the Greens have been counted out before. So when Bob Brown, the founder of the Greens, left politics, you know, he had such a cold of personality. He was definitely the figurehead for the Greens, and everyone said that once he left, when he resigned, that the Greens would collapse. It was just about Bob Brown. Obviously, that's not the case, and the Greens have increased their vote in the years since Bob Brown left politics. So, you know, we do, I think there is an appetite in Australia for a third party and a party that is more to the left than Liberal and Labor, as we've seen. So I don't know. There's nowhere else for people to put those votes except...
For the time being.
Yeah. Especially if... Richard can hold down the fort, I suppose.
You're listening to Backchat on FBI 94.5. Look, one of the biggest battles in Sydney over politics in the last few years has been over the $16 billion WestConnex toll road. The major road project's been described by the state government as the so-called missing link in Sydney's motorway network, and the idea is that it'll eventually connect up two of our main motorways, the M4 in the west and the M5 in the southwest. And the project so far has seen 200 homes acquired for construction. Residents aren't particularly happy about this, and more of them are concerned about increased traffic in the affected areas as well. Today, anti-WestConnex community groups will be staging a peaceful protest where they'll be walking along a section of one of the proposed tunnelling sites in Camperdown. And though the WestConnex is a New South Wales government initiative, it's also bled into federal and local politics. The City of Sydney has proposed a radical overhaul of the project, and we've got Councillor Jess Miller in the studio to talk to us about all things WestConnex. Thanks for joining us,
Jess. Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good, good. It's great to have you in the studio. Do you mind just kicking off by walking us through where the project is up to?
Yeah, well, I think the government would probably have us believe that it's a lot more progressed than it actually is. As far as we can see, it's sort of toward the end of stage one and beginning stage two. So what we've seen is the widening that's happened.
Widening of the road?
The widening of the road of the M4. We've seen the preparation of some of the dive sites, and we've seen a lot of construction. But I suppose what's really interesting with this road project is that the vast majority of it is actually underground. So as a government who's trying to sell this thing, as much the community, but probably more so at this stage to potential investors, there's been a lot of talk about it being a lot more far progressed than it actually is.
So you think the government is trying to get the message out there that, look, it's happening, it's definitely going to happen, it's too late to wind it back
because
it wants to, like, look like that's what's going
on. Oh, yeah, you see those banners everywhere. It's like, making it happen, it's happening, you know, they keep saying it's happening, it's happening, it's happening. The reality is that some things are happening, but it is not yet at the point where it can't be amended and it can't be adapted, and we saw that with the deletion of the Camperdown interchange. So that was something that we know that there is some nimbleness and dexterity in the minister.
Yeah, you're right, they do keep kind of changing it as they're going along,
and you know, that's not a bad thing. And I think what council is proposing is not actually that radical. It's a much more simple version. It's an alternative. There may be many more alternatives, but what we're trying to say is that rather than just like push this thing ahead and spend so much money and do that all kind of under this great shroud of secrecy, it's probably a more sensible idea to really stop, take account of what people are saying, and really interrogate some alternatives like public transport. So, alternative routes.
So before we get into the City of Sydney's sort of proposal, like, can we just go back to the start? So obviously this WestConnex was proposed because Sydney's growing, especially in the west. You know, anyone that's driven down Parramatta Road in recent times will know it's like hell on earth. Mm-hmm. You know, does the City of Sydney like recognise the need for such a project, and you know, putting up barriers and protests against it, like in your view, you know, because you don't represent the far west, are you not taking their views into account sufficiently? You know, that's some of the criticisms that have been levelled at the council.
Yeah, and I think that's really understandable. When you interrogate the details of the project, though, and when you also compare the details of the project to the other dialogue that the Greater Sydney Commission, for example, have been talking about, of this need to really decentralise, you know, jobs and growth from the centre and start focusing on infrastructure on the west. The idea of building this huge arterial vein that drops traffic straight into the city, and it seems to be really in opposition to that whole idea. I think what the city would suggest and would encourage is working with the other, you know, city centres and really developing infrastructure there, because we don't think that people should have to be driving or on a train or anything for more than, you know, half an hour. And we have that in common with the state government. So it just seems really odd and more of a kind of legacy business case from a bunch of bankers to be, you know, ploughing ahead with this, when what would be more sensible would be to build up local infrastructure and build up capacity in our outer cities.
So you mean like making Parramatta into more of a business centre and showing,
100%,
you know, public transport between the city and Parramatta?
Yeah, I mean, you know, and it's also the economic burden on people from the west as well too. Like, you know, Lucy Turnbull's idea of there being three cities, and Sydney being the tale of three cities. I think that's a great idea. And the City of Sydney would really welcome that. And if you're having to come in from somewhere like Penrith to the city for work every day, you should be able to have options. So you shouldn't be forced to drive all the way into the city, because that's going to cost you money in tolls. It's going to cost you a shit ton of money in parking, and it's going to cost you a hell of a lot of time as well. So I think everybody, if that's what you needed to come into work, I think everybody can agree that it would be much better use of everyone's time and money to get, you know, be on a 35-minute train trip.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that the government at the same time has this decentralisation agenda where it wants to move businesses elsewhere, but its landmark infrastructure project is this $16 billion pipeline that just pulls everyone from the West and dumps them in Alexandria, St. Peter's, and then says kind of go to the city.
Yeah, I think the ongoing myth of the dissipation wand is a really interesting one. So the question that the city is asked time and again is, so where does the traffic go once it enters into the inner rim? And the minister at the time said, oh, it'll just dissipate. And I've been wondering where this magical, like, dissipation wand is, because I could use that. That would be really handy.
Yeah, yeah. We could keep talking, because I live in Alexandria and I'm very interested in that question as well, but maybe it's a bit too niche for the rest of our listeners. But just quickly, because the city does have responsibility, I guess, in a way, at least in terms of the public, for amenities and services in the City of Sydney area, are you guys worried about the backlash? Say the project goes ahead and you end up with a situation where you've got tens of thousands of extra cars being dumped, you know, into the inner city. Are you worried that people then, oh, why isn't the City of Sydney dealing with this? Like, what are you supposed to do?
Well, yeah, I mean, already community groups are really concerned about it. Definitely in Newtown and the affected residents in St. Peter's and Newtown who have had their homes taken from them have been really concerned. People around Alexandria have been really concerned about what it's going to mean for the livability of their streets. But I think what's really interesting at the moment too is the concern that's not just coming from the city but from people in the northern suburbs with the announcement of the Beaches Link and the secrecy around where Smokestack's going to be. It's not really NIMBYism on behalf of the city when it's in everybody's backyards, and increasingly we're seeing that people from the West are concerned. We've had groups from Penrith and Parramatta get in touch with local groups. There's something crazy like 30 local resident action groups coming to us at the moment, because when they're trying to get information from Sydney Motorway Corporation or the government, they're just falling blind. It's all falling on deaf ears. You can't even read the maps. They're intentionally obfuscated. Like, it's really difficult to get information and answers. And I think we saw that this week with the leaked documents from Cabinet, where they'd said that the location of the smokestacks next to schools has already been decided without any community consultation whatsoever.
Right. So walk us through the City of Sydney's own WestConnex alternative, I suppose. Mm-hmm. You guys have put forward an alternative that sort of has some of the same goals, I suppose, but takes a different approach. What have you proposed?
So originally the purpose of WestConnex was trying to get better linkages to the airport and to try and get as much freight off the road as possible. So a lot of the congestion that happens...
You don't really hear about either of those things anymore.
No, it's kind of oddly fallen off the agenda. And it was introduced initially by the federal, then-federal minister for planning, Anthony Albanese, and they put in the first couple of billion dollars or however many...
That's an important point, isn't it? Because people often forget that it was a federal Labor government at the time that Kate gave the first funding to start the project.
The first kick-in, yeah, and it was. And I think the intention behind it at that point was quite a good one. It makes sense to get to relieve congestion. And in short, what our plan does is really goes back to that original intentions and looks at ways that we can take out a lot of the congestion from the airport. So the airport bit is what's really crushing a lot of those people, you know, in Banksia, Arncliffe, that experience that, like, just getting in is really difficult. So there's a couple of things that we've done. We've gotten rid of the St. Peter's interchange, so there's not going to be that big dump right in the middle of the city. We've thrown a bit of public transport into the mix, so extending the metro has been something that we've been looking at. We've been looking at the charges that come in to the city and removing those mm-hmm. as a way to encourage people to use public transport to get to the city. Because if for a lot of people, it's like, oh, God, if I'm going to get slogged $16 for a train to get to the airport, I might as well get a cab. Mm-hmm. And so that piece of infrastructure has already paid for itself. So there's no reason why we shouldn't get rid of that as just like a quick win. I guess our plan is really just about simplifying, saving money. It's an alternative. It's not the alternative, but I think when there's this much money at stake and these many homes at stake and this much disruption over not just like 5-10 years, we're talking like 30-40 years of ongoing disruption, and like, it's really worthwhile to stop and hit the pause button and just be open to different alternatives. We haven't even really considered what kinds of technologies will be available to us, like, in 5-10 years from now, and that might change the game as well. So,
for sure. Jess, we're nearly out of time, but we mentioned at the top that there's going to be a protest in Camperdown today. And it's you got lanterns or something. Do you mind walking us through that one?
So the lantern march is happening all across the inner area tonight. There are a whole range of different starting points. So the best way to figure out where your closest starting point is to get onto the West Connect Action Group's Facebook page, get the information there. What we'll be doing is we'll be walking the route of the tunnels underneath to give people a bit of an understanding of what's actually going to be underground.
Cool.
Because in some spots it's like 3 stories of tunnels, 300 metres deep. And I don't think people really conceive of that unless you make it visual. So, you know, the lanterns, the symbology of the lantern is that it's always been a warning sign. So we really encourage people to come down. It kicks off around about 4:30. There'll be sausages, there'll be fun. It's just a very simple, peaceful,
a great Saturday afternoon out. Jess,
bring
Miller.
The kids, bring the dogs.
Jess Miller from the City of Sydney, thank you so much for joining us on Backchat.
Thank you for having me.
And unfortunately, that's all we've got time for today, and thanks for tuning in. If you missed anything, subscribe and listen to our podcast by searching Backchat on iTunes. And while you're there, leave us a review. It just helps other people find us and learn more about Australian politics. If you ever want to get in touch, hit us up on Facebook and Twitter. And we'd like to thank the following awesome team for their help today: Oscar Coleman, Emily Jane Smith, Kathy Boris, Linda Hong. And tune in next week, of course, for another awesome show.